I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close, but not too close, reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Michael S. Hennessy, poet, teacher, critic, super talented audiographer. You ever been called an audiographer before, Mike?
It's a first for everything.
Exactly what you are. Author of Last Days in the Bomb Shelter and of many essays, including a recent one on Charles Bernstein's early scream piece, 1 to 100. What year was that? 1969? He was such a young man at the time. Currently
scream
teaching
piece?
Scream piece. 99.
That's what I count from
100. Currently teaching, that is Mike, at the University of Cincinnati, editor of Penn Sound, and with Julia Block, editor at Jacket 2 magazine, and by the aforementioned Charles Bernstein, who is the author of 42 books by now, collections of poetry, essays, pamphlets, libretti, translations, and collaborations, whose volume of selected poems, All the Whiskey in Heaven, was recently published, and whose new book is Attack of the Difficult Poems, and who, with me, I'm honored to say, is co-founder and co-director of Penn Sound. And by Marjorie Perloff, super eminent critic and literary historian of modern and contemporary poetry and poetics, author of many, many books, including a memoir, The Vienna Paradox, hundreds of essays and reviews. I threw hundreds of in there, but I think that's right, maybe thousands, whose most recent book is Unoriginal Genius, Poetry by Other Means in the New Century, and who, I'm happy to say, is by now a longtime friend of the Kelly Writer's House, and is indeed on this very day we record being honored as a Kelly Writer's House Fellow. Welcome back to Poem Talk, Charles. Hello.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you on the third floor. And Mike, nice to see you in from Cincy.
Thank you for the
and
invite.
And on Poem Talk for the first time, which is my fault. You need to have been on Poem Talk before this. And Marjorie, what fun it's been having you here in Philly.
It's been a wonderful time.
Back
Thank
home.
You, Al.
And thanks for joining us. Today, we, the four of us, are talking about a poem by Tom Raworth titled Errory. E-R-R-O-R-Y. It was published in Clean and Well Lit, the book, in 1996, and is one of the poems reprinted in the great Carcanet Press Tom Raworth Collected Poems. And our recording of Errory comes from audio material produced in 2004 by the Contemporary Poetics Research Center at Birkbeck College, University of London, and we thank Colin Still for making these recordings available to Penn Sound. So here now is Tom Raworth reading Errory.
Errory. Joint harmonizing the best, so it needn't wait phrase. The question, are you sure? Hanging 3 feet off the ground, silent, absolutely quiet. Headquarters, we travelled north, clawing back small shelter, hung with screaming on the same rig, blended in enthusiasm as the race approached through cracks in snow, free falling into mind, alive with brightness, shivering instantly into sleep, changed, reformed. They run with madness into shoots of changed values, all of them conventional vibrations of division. Dare to refuse the glass, lazily through long green discreet landing sites to a transmitting unit over the protective line. Wave patterns in space form black against sifted patches of moonlight. Birds move in the dark, their faint contours singing small notes to the rhythm of a train. So empty at this hour, silence in between contains the words things whiz past. Once more the sound of calculation or indirect means receives its full due. Along the wet pavement, human flesh fallen in all directions to fresh eyes, something to do with the sky. Senselessly dishevelled, resolves and fixes the foundation, desirable to guard against relative soundness of approach, including human shapes used by the dealer, connecting them to a sense of common, unforeseeable properties of relics, considered in place, so deceptive their firesides play optimism for its object without arousing constitutional tradition beyond the rules of the game. Hailstones imagine moist sea air, disordered beyond it rise drearier philosophies to resist retrogression, faster than anything directly stimulating receptors. Attention moves many possible representations inside the hearts decayed into blackness. Fine details of the scene creep along for years, hard to become immune to a predator. Silhouettes of participants dangle in their own data. Faint green clouds in almost pure alcohol calibrate the equipment to assume a more personal form, susceptible to psychic influences. Does not contempt breed often in disguise, slipping past a window on communal stairs into faded yellow, flashed with orange, slanting through smoke, swished into a perfect dome, dissatisfied when calm returns, centred around a food animal, mastery of areas managed to neutralise subjects into waves to destroy communication more easily on scanty pastures.
Mike Hennessy, what do you hear? I mean, just try to imagine not seeing this on a page. What did you hear?
cheetahs. No. the speed works against semantics in a way. But what's striking for me, maybe I'm reading this through Tom's own childhood during the London Blitz, is a lot of war imagery, violent imagery that fits.
Give us some examples.
Well, headquarters, we traveled north, clawing back small shelter hung with screaming, discreet landing sites to a transmitting unit over the protective line, both violent imagery, but also the technical imagery of war, the lexicon of war.
That's great. Are you implying that this is in part a memory?
Maybe I'll get into this more later. I see a sort of multifarious time frame here. And this is Raworth is writing in the mid 90s. Raworth always has sort of war as a preoccupation, it seems. So maybe he's thinking of contemporary wars at this time, the war in the Balkans. But it seems as if growing up, he was born in 1938, and the first 7 years of his life living with bombing when many children had gone away to the countryside. It seems like that's always there as a frame of reference for him.
Marjorie, what do you think of that reading so far?
I agree completely that it's basically a war poem. First, I thought it was some kind of adventure, you know, an account of a mission. There's some kind of mission going on. So first I thought, oh, it's a mission to the North Pole, something like that, because the cracks in snow, the free falling into mine. But then you realize that madness into chutes. Basically, there's some kind of battle going on here, and you're not sure whether it's submarines, whether it's on land or on water. That's the great thing Raworth manages to do. It suggests some terrible mission that's very dangerous, and it goes by super fast, the whole story, but and it isn't one coherent story, but it is basically, it has the curve of some kind of terrifying battle and somebody recounting. And it doesn't matter what war it is, really. It's sort of all wars. And in fact, I think he purposely uses vocabulary that suggests different arms. There's the rig, there are chutes, there are all kinds of different images here, the transmitting unit, so that you're not sure, is it the Gulf War? Is it the Balkan War? It could be pretty much anything, but it's what it's like to go through that experience.
Charles, let's go back to the sound. Why does he read it the way he does? He doesn't read every one of his poems like this.
He often reads very fast, and just sort of, we often think of him as the fastest reading poet around. And it's a very different experience to hear that reading, or actually to see him perform, and to read it. Of course, you lose the line breaks, which is so crucial when you go back
you lose
and read
them all.
It.
He enjams everything.
He enjams everything. So, although now having studied it in a way I hadn't before, I can sort of hear how the lines, you know, pop out against the continuous flow. But I think he's interested in a very rapid, continuous flow of information and sound that's throttled back and forth. So it's either like a kaleidoscope or like a Möbius strip, so that every line suggests something and then it's torqued slightly and something else. But rather than to dwell on each thing separately, he runs it together, much as perception. So sometimes you could say that Raworth is not the flow of consciousness in that Joycean sense of stream of consciousness, with the flow of perception. And I was about to say that until I actually start to read this poem.
And then you realize
it isn't
not
true.
It's not
it isn't
flow
true
of
to say that.
What is it then?
Well, there's a mix of different kinds of things, including what Marjorie and Michael have said. It's discursive elements. It's memory elements. It is certainly perception, and it is consciousness. It's
how
memory
about verbal
and torqued
sound,
each.
How about sound and?
Well, there's
certainly
that
a way
continuous
of understanding the flow. Well, sometimes.
I think actually Raworth says this somewhere. One of the reasons it goes so fast, you couldn't do this with any poem, and actually it's more British than American. It's all dependent clauses. If you go through here, all the clauses are dependent clauses.
Can you give
clauses.
Us a couple examples?
We traveled north, clawing back small shelter, hung with screaming on the same rig, blended in enthusiasm. It all is a continuous sentence. So it's the opposite of, say, the poetry of the noun phrase, you know, where, you, of course, you're going to stop at lines more readily. When you have a series of noun phrases, so you stop. Here, change, reform, they run with madness into shoots of changed values, all of them conventional, vibrations of divisions, dare to refuse the glass. So you just keep on going, and he wants it to be this, you know, incredible. I agree with Charles. It isn't really the flow of perception as much, because, again, I think there's a lot here that's mediated. There's a lot of television language and things of hearing the news. It's like hearing the news on CNN, and you get a couple of phrases. There are phrases here that dare to refuse the glass, you know, things that sound like some newscaster is probably
saying. It's 2 to 6 word lines, I think, the lines themselves. Yeah. Of course, his famous poem, Ace, is single words, and he does that. You think he could read each single word slow, but he does that in the same way, so that it's just...
But they do, it is so continuous.
They connect, yeah.
Let's go back to Mike's first observation about, he didn't say the word landscape, but that's what I was thinking. Fine details of the scene. You implied, although you were mixing World War II in it, it does feel like a post-industrial pastoral. It feels like there are machines on the landscape, equipment on the landscape. Do you want to go in this direction, or am I wrong-headed?
Well, I'll go with machine through media mediation, sort of playing off of Marjorie and Charles's last comments. The shortness of the line... And where we start, not in sort of this war of violence, but joined harmonizing the best so it needn't wait. What this really sounds like to me is the language of advertising, which is received through the radio, through the television.
So how do you link that to the war theme?
Well, if he's writing in the 1990s, this is really, I mean, Vietnam is in essence our first media war, but it's the first Gulf War, it's the Balkan War with CNN nonstop 24/7 coverage, where we really see the war industry, the war entertainment, and I think that's in part.
And yet
what
we traveled north
to.
Seems to be quasi-memory of leaving the scene of war to get away to safety, no?
Mm. Yes.
No? Yeah?
Not necessarily. You travel north right into battle, too.
Marjorie, in another context, you were writing about a different poem, Letters from Yaddo. You said the inability to have access to one's experience colors much of Raworth's poetry. Does that seem relevant here, that observation?
Yeah, these are not poems. One of the reasons Raworth is so difficult and doesn't really fit into any group, very hard to put him, to categorize him, is I don't think it is a series of memories or even any kind of flow of consciousness. It's constantly switching, which makes it very tricky. Now, John Wilkinson, who's a good friend of his, but said of Ace, and I brought that in because I wanted to see what Michael and Charles and you have thought about this. He says, it's both a strength and a weakness in Raworth's poetry that nothing is examined but everything is registered, which is a kind of criticism, and I'm not sure I agree with the critical side of that, that nothing is examined but everything is registered. But there is something to that. Everything is registered, and you can't take any one line and say, aha, traveling north means away from this. You're just not sure. Harmonizing the best does sound like some kind of rah-rah account of war, and hanging 3 feet off the ground, oh boy, you know, and it was exciting. It was this great adventure. We were hanging 3 feet off the ground, and then it undercuts it. But he doesn't really allow you to stay with one voice at all, or even with one sensibility, even in a sense. And I thought that was an interesting comment of Wilkinson's. He said, nothing is established, but everything is possible. Nothing is examined and everything is registered. What do you think?
Well, I think everything is established and little is possible, for one thing. But I think the concept of registration is good, the constant shift. If I were to have listened to this poem, I might not typically with Raworth have reflected on it the way I did, thinking I'd be on this show and talking about it. I wouldn't necessarily have tried to figure it out. And I think that, you know, is partly, no doubt, what John Wilkinson is talking about. You sort of listen to it and let it
wash over you.
It washes
In this kaleidoscopic way. And over time, you see that there are these different elements which are constantly permutated or repermutated. Of course, you know, you could say that one of the remarkable things he does, and this relates to aspects of Creeley that he takes from Creeley, is the the issue of disjunction, conjunction, because for him, disjunction, this certainly speaks to the point that Marjorie made about the kinds of phrases that are brought together or sutured, so that everything is sutured together. It doesn't seem exactly as if they're distinct, and yet everything is separate. So to me, I think to a conventional reader or a listener looking for a more narrative lyric voice, obviously it's very disjunct or abstract.
Free falling into mind, alive with brightness, shivering instantly into sleep, changed, reformed. They run with madness into shoots of changed values, all of them conventional vibrations of division. Dare to refuse the glass, lazily through long green discrete landing sites to a transmitting unit over the protective line. Wave patterns in space form black against sifted patches of moonlight. Birds move in the dark, their faint contours singing small notes to the rhythm of a train, so empty at this hour.
Let's say you come to poetry after a certain period of time and you're trying to fit. Raworth Marjorie has already suggested that he doesn't fit very well, so we're going to be very gentle with this, but he doesn't fit. Marjorie, in the same essay I was referring to before, says that he's better received in the U.S. than in England, yet he's still generally not as well known as one would like because he's such a great poet. Where does he fit? How if you want to purchase on where Raworth fits, not that that's crucially important, but it's worth considering, how do you proceed?
It's an interesting model for, say, the transnational power of the new American poetry, in a sense. It was interesting going back to Charles's close listening interview
with
Raworth. And he has a very complex relationship with British poetry, with English poetry, where it seems as if where all of his affinities lie, whether that bears out on the page, or rather just an ideological harmony, is in that Black Mountain School, is in, say, Ashbery, perhaps, but especially Creeley with the very short line, and Dorn is cited frequently as a very close friend, but also sort of comrade in arms aesthetically.
Margie, what do you think about this?
I think, but it's Donald Davy in a way that pushed both Raworth and Dorn and Creeley in England and so forth. I actually have come around to thinking that with all that association of 21 plus one, where Raworth is the
can
one.
Can you explain that reference?
And 21 plus one is the Jacques Roubaud anthology in Diggy of American poets, the 21 American poets, new poets, and Raworth is the one English poet. I think, though, it's going to turn out later that he's much more English, and I've already thought that, listening to this reading, than we think. As I say, these dependent clauses, his syntax is very different from American syntax in many ways. And actually, he's more popular, Al, than you just a minute ago gave credit to, I think, in the sense that since his Carcanet book came out, he is very
pages.
Much recognized in England, and there was a piece about him by, of all people, Hugo Williams. I don't know if you know who that is, but in the TLS, Hugo Williams has that column almost every week. That I think he's a poet, Hugo Williams, but just sort of a general column, and it's usually very belles lettres kind of column. And he raves about, he gave a reading together recently at Birkbeck College last December or so with Raworth. And he absolutely said, I was almost embarrassed to read with him because he's so much better. And he was so wonderful and he won the audience over and people really liked it. So I think he has arrived and in an interesting way, because, in fact, he's not so much like Dorn or some of the other poets in the sense that he is so aware of popular culture and especially television and radio discourse on politics and newspaper headlines. And we all know what his collages and so on, you know, are like. And yet he doesn't make an argument. He's never bad tempered in a way or very rarely, you know, he just lets it be out there. And on the other hand, of course, it is very difficult poetry. I mean, I'm so startled when I come to something like calibrate the equipment to assume a more personal form. Mm-hmm. How does equipment assume a more personal form? I don't know.
Faint green clouds in almost pure alcohol calibrate the equipment to assume a more personal form, susceptible to psychic influences. Does not contempt breed often in disguise? Slipping past a window on communal stairs into faded yellow, flashed with orange, slanting through smoke, swished into a perfect dome, dissatisfied when calm returns, centred around a food animal, mastery of areas managed to neutralise subjects into waves to destroy communication more easily on scanty pastures.
There's remarkable number of lines in the poem which seem to be self-reflections on the poetic process itself, or could be understood that way.
Indeed.
And they almost, when you start to read it, it almost seems like they all changed, reformed, could be the way in which each line works, the changes and reforms.
To destroy communication, maybe?
Absolutely. Wave patterns in space was exactly what we were talking about before. We even groped lines like that. Form black against and contains the words. The sound of calculation. All of these things. Attention moves. Fallen in all directions. All of these things are descriptions of what we have discussed in this program. Connecting them is a very specific relative soundness of approach, which is very, very funny if you think about, as your question to me about what the relation of the sound had to do with the connection of one thing to the next. Senselessly disheveled is another, does it make sense or not? Two fresh eyes is the sort of it's new. Disordered beyond its rise. To resist retrogression, not progression, but to resist going backward, because it is so forward moving in that sense.
So I'm gonna pick some phrases
faster
that go in a different
than anything.
Direction, Charles.
Not everyone, but those do.
And I know that this is probably wrong, but I see when I read Raworth, I think of all kinds of cognates and interests and influences. If you slow this way, way, way down, and you pick out what I described as the pastoral phrases, I almost hear Grenier's sentences. This sounds weird, but birds move in the dark. Wet pavement. Faint green clouds. That may be ridiculous, but I just thought I'd add that.
And Mike, the last line is scanty pastures.
Scanty pastures. I see it interleaving in here. This strange wartime pastoral. I'm going to ask
it's strange because I have a very different take on that.
Yeah, I know, but I want to ask you a different question. The title, Errory. Tell us about it.
This could be totally off base, but maybe this fits with the birds. I think of Errory is in an adjectival sense of having the quality of error, but I'm also thinking of Errory.
Oh, Errory is an adjective. I was thinking it's a noun, a place where errors.
Well, that's
get
what I was going to say. In the way that an aviary is where you find birds, an errory is where
like Laureen Whittaker's condensery.
From. Yes,
the place where the poem gets made.
And space. The spaces of this poem are interesting. There's a lot of the pastoral, there's a lot of the landscape in this openness, and war creates openness and destruction.
It does,
but
yeah.
War also creates these confined spaces, and to go back to Raworth, under the table, waiting out the bombs. The train has this containment, the stairwell.
Nice.
The communal stairs. And those scenes, those are both scenes where, in the midst of this litany of phrases, at least to my ear, you get... For three or four lines, the pass in a split second when he's reading it, especially, you get a little bit of an anchor, a little bit of a scene before you're then hurtled off into the poem again.
So, Marjorie, let's go with Error.
I love the title, and the title, typical sort of Raworth title. First of all, if you look up Errory on Google, you immediately get the message, you mean Error? Do you mean Tom Raworth Error?
That would be the second one. The first one would be the pen sound page, probably.
Error is one thing.
That
I took it adjectivally. What is errory? Errory sounds like a permanent state of affairs. It's also errory. I mean, I made an error. Do you realize it's the opposite of what the word means? If I say I made an error, that's one thing. I did pretty well on the exam, but I made an error. I made an error. That's one thing, usually. But errory makes it sound as if everything is full of errors. It was such an errory trip. You know, it's a condition. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very funny in a way and also kind of scary. And I think one thing he's saying here, and I don't think that is even so much memory, is that in the battle itself, the generals, all the orders given, it's all errory. You know, it turns out they gave all the wrong directions and the wrong things, and so they're probably going the wrong way.
Speaking of direction, Marjorie, I keep thinking of something that Ashbery in recent years said in a poem. What does it mean to say the wind is blowing in the wrong direction? What does it mean to say a poem is going in the wrong direction? Error? It's just going to do what it does. You know, in a way, there's no such thing as error here.
Yeah, but here there's only error. Everything is errory. You
that
know?
Too. Let's go around. One last thing that you think must be said in a definitive discussion of this poem,
well,
Charles.
I want to pick up on the lines you read, and just if this was a poem by itself read slowly, it would be an entirely different experience that you'd have.
Right.
Birds move in the dark, their faint contours, singing small notes to the rhythm of a train, so empty at this hour, silence in between. Mm. And that is a beautiful sort of
a little
and
lyric.
By the way, to the rhythm of a train could also be understood as a kind of metapoetic comment, but that itself is a sort of the extension of what you were saying. Mm. In the middle of this poem is this poem.
Mike, last thought?
This is perhaps a misreading, but I'm quite struck by the three-dimensionality of this poem, and I resisted listening to the audio for the longest time until I had gotten a handle on it. And it's interesting to see in Marjorie's version in Clean and Well Lit that this is presented in a single column, whereas in the Carcanet to Save Space, they've done it as twin columns on the page. Because the more that I kept going over it, my inclination was to read across the lines with this break. And in many cases,
he doesn't do this often. You think it's the Carcanet edition or a Raworth? I assume it was Raworth.
Perhaps his decision, but in
not
that
here.
Edition,
no,
it's...
Not.
So it is the edition.
Yeah.
They
saving
just
space.
Thought, oh, well, small lines, we're going to save a few dollars.
Well, yeah, they probably did.
But you're saying that seeing it on the page, you thought you
find
might
it just
read
as interesting,
across.
If not in some case a more interesting reading, even though it allowed, or it cuts through some of those scenes that I find and that I enjoy. It makes as much sense. It makes more sense with that possibility of multiple readings reinforcing.
So we should stop recommending Penn Sound because you listen to it and you know how he wanted to read.
Kind
it.
Of like saying read the book before you see the movie,
something like that.
Read the
or
poem before you
reverse.
Hear the poem.
Marjorie, your last thought on this?
The two things I wanted to call attention to: the third line. The question, are you sure? That's a kind of Raworth trademark, that everything is going along in this impersonal way with no particular voice. And then you break into just conversation. Are you sure? And when you hear him read that, that's striking too, where you suddenly realize there is somebody there reading this. Are you sure? And you get that in neighboring poems all the time. There'll be some suddenly personal intrusion. The other thing I want to say is that each line, even though he reads them so fast, you don't quite get that when you hear it, alive with brightness, shivering, where shivering is an I rhyme with alive and brightness. Every line is very carefully wrought. But the most peculiar feature, and that's a feature of Raworth in general, is that there's a kind of seamless switch from high style to low, and yet it isn't a collage. It isn't like what some people do is collage things together, which would be easier in a way. You have lines that seem quite high style, like alive with brightness, shivering. It's not exactly conversational. And then, though, you suddenly will get to another thing, to a transmitting unit, that's a very different kind of register. So he's constantly shifting registers, and the faster he goes, you have that strange thing of a modern mentality, current mentality that shifts registers in that very, very strange way that I don't know of another poet who does. Creeley doesn't do that at all. I don't think he's like Creeley. He's not like Dorn particularly. You know, it's always interesting the differences. There really isn't another poet who does that particular thing, because, as I say, it's not at all collaged, and yet it's not. In Creeley, you would have much greater consistency than you have here.
And speaking of bright shivering, the book in which this appeared, Clean and Well Lit, I mean, I don't know, I'm assuming that the phrase comes from Hemingway, Clean, Well-Lighted Place. And that's the Hemingway that I admire. I don't admire a lot of Hemingway after about 1925, but this is the Hemingway that wanted to clear, in the Steinian sense, wanted to clear and create something fresh. And it reminds me to read Raworth as someone who really is in that tradition of seeing words newly and sort of clearing connotation and so forth. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of what we call Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow Dickinsonian hands and gather something really poetically good or something you'd recommend in the poetry world. And I'll start with Charles, who looks like he's... Paradise.
Well,
himself.
I'm going to be somewhat narrow in a way rather than spreading wise, but since with three of us together, I can't but mention jacket2.org, co-edited by Michael Hennessy, and Al and I have our commentaries, our blogs have been moved over to there.
Great, jacket2.org. Mike, speaking of jacket?
We'll stay in the website phase. I'm quite struck recently with C.A. Conrad's new video journal of poetics, Jupiter 88. Which is jupiter88.blogspot.com, I believe. And this was the centerpiece of an essay I just wrote about digital poetics. I see it as this exciting form of online mimography. And in this case, particularly centered around Coterie. It's all his social circle. It's where he's going. It's who's coming to Philadelphia and who he's interacting with. In fact, I will...
And it's videos, mostly.
Videos. Mm-hmm. I will be doing my own little bit tomorrow, I think, perhaps.
That's a plug.
Because I came to town.
Okay. Great. We're glad you did. Marjorie?
I'll say something about somebody of Ray Worth's generation, namely David Anton, since the and give a plug to his Radical Coherency, the new collection of some of very old art essays that are now out. I think it's wonderful that this book finally came out. I know both Charles and I worked very hard to get David to publish these essays. And when I looked at it all together, finally in print, after all the ups and downs, leaving out pieces, putting in pieces, so on, it really does make for a radical coherent novel, and shows, you know, some of the problems, earlier problems already in the 60s that have now become even perhaps more problematic and that are interesting. So that's a book I recommend very much, although I don't like the cover.
Well, that's all the scanty pasture we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Mike Hennessy, Charles Bernstein, and Marjorie Perloff, and to Poem Talk's guest engineer today. It's not Chris Mostaza, but it is Adam Podlosky, thank you so much for sitting in, Adam, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.